Hey, good afternoon and welcome, everybody. It is Thursday afternoon at 1 p.m. in Radio X, and that means it's time for Family Business Radio. Through Family Business Radio, we are here to showcase family businesses and build communities designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. So each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. And I am Pat Romboletti with Sage Executive Search, one of your hosts, and my co-host is
Meredith Moore with Moore & Associates Wealth Management.
Welcome.
I'm excited to be here. I have two of my favorite gentlemen sitting in here that I've done a good bit of work on the professional side with, so I'm happy to hear what they have to say today.
Great.
A little bit about today, though. Really, with us focusing on family business, it's important to understand that running a family business in the U.S., while it has its own challenges, people need to remember that things can get very interesting when you also have family holdings and business entities outside of our borders. There are many things to think about, all the way from understanding the culture and the customs to making sure that you have good financial and legal advisors who are on your team that truly understand those laws and regulations where you are looking to operate. Today, our guests both know this topic very well and will be able to share valuable insights that can help you avoid costly mistakes. So if you decide that it's time to take your business global, you can be prepared with what Eric and Richard have to say today.
Great. Thanks, Meredith. That's a great intro. And I want to introduce our guest first, Richard Bennett. Richard is a shareholder with the law firm of Kitchens, Kelly & Gaines. Welcome, Richard.
Oh, thank you, Pat.
Yeah. Richard, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Well, yes. I'm a business attorney. I advise business owners and help them protect and grow their assets in their business. Spent some time overseas, actually, in Bermuda for 3 years. So I picked up a little bit of interest in this field since then, and really been at Kitchens Kelly Gaines since 98. So I've been there for a while. Great bunch of people over there.
And what is the firm? Do they have other areas of practice?
Yeah, well, we got 16 attorneys over there, and they focus on various aspects of business, from commercial real estate to protecting creditors through bankruptcy, to SBA lending and refinancings.
Excellent. Sounds like a well-rounded firm. And our other guest is Eric Papp. And Eric has been a senior executive, has broad international background, and been with, and we'll explain a little bit later on about some of his involvement in family businesses. But Eric, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Eric, tell us a little bit about your background. Tell folks where you're from and the time that you spent here. And I know that you passed through one of the hallowed institutions that happens to be Meredith's favorite here in Atlanta.
Yes, I did. I was born in Honduras, left Honduras when I was 11. The family moved to the Philippine Islands because of my father's work. After 3 years in the Philippines, I moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where I went to high school. Upon graduating from high school, by chance, more than anything else, I landed in Georgia Tech, where I graduated as a civil engineer in 1981. From there, I went down to Ecuador, where my parents were living at that time. And the reason I went there, because there was a little bit of problems in Central America, and it wasn't too safe, especially with all the conflicts going on. I was planning to spend 2 years there and come back and follow my education with a master's degree. But as things turned out, I spent 28 years in Ecuador. And
you met your lovely wife there, right?
Yes, I did. And had now I have three wonderful sons. And in June of 2008, we got our residency papers for the U.S., so it was another life-changing decision we had to make with the wife. And we decided to move up, and settle here in Atlanta.
Excellent. Well, I think we could do a whole other show on what it's like to relocate a family to Ecuador, especially with three sons. I think Meredith shared with me that it was the grace of God that you found Georgia Tech, Eric. So I just want to mention that.
Yes, it was.
But what our show today is really going to focus on the businesses, business entities, and those that operate with a foot or one foot in each another continent. So, Eric, can you share a little bit about your background, more about that, working with family businesses after you went down to Ecuador?
Well, I started that after 8 years of working in the construction industry. When that tanked, I had the opportunity to come in into this joint venture with some Ecuadorian partners, and I went into agriculture, specifically banana production mainly. There's some other cocoa bean production, cattle production, but the big cash product is bananas. There I've spent the 20-plus years as a general manager doing basically all managerial operations concerned with this type of business.
You know, there's an image in America of the good old days when the farm, you know, you saw the tractor and you saw dad and the boys out baling the hay, or maybe a little machine came along. But I have a sense that the farm that you were working on was a little bit more technology geared than that.
Definitely, yes. Now that in this type of industry, the infrastructure is really big. It's very labor intensive, so you can't. It's not done that way anymore. It's all technical, and the main part of my job was to guide the management team towards the goals we had set up.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't sound like the role of a normal, what we would perceive to be, general manager. I mean, can you kind of explain what that entailed? I mean, obviously, if you're handling a big banana manufacturing plant, I mean, talk to us a little bit what that looked like.
Well, it is not at all. I mean, general manager usually bring to mind somebody that's running a little store or a quick food restaurant. The general manager in this in Ecuador specifically has a broad
like responsibilities.
Responsibilities. Yeah. He runs. He's basically the CEO. He's the CFO. He's the COO. He's his CTO. He's a company consul, and so on and so forth. I mean, you have to oversee all the aspects of the business operation. It's not just one specific thing. I mean, you have to deal with all types of multifunctional professionals. Be they just technicals, accountants, economists, lawyers, a lot of lawyers.
Too many, I'm sure.
Yeah, quite a bit. Human relations, human resources. It's every, you have to cover everything. It's not, and you report directly to the owners. So in essence, I would basically call it like a CEO position.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sounds like it. Yeah.
Well, one thing about that is an interesting point in different countries, they have different understandings about what certain titles mean. You know, I've been to some, dealt with some people overseas who, you know, were very adamant that they were a CEO, not a president. You know, just because of their perspective on that was much different than what we have here in the United States.
So the rankings, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that along the way, Richard, you and Eric crossed paths, and you have served as a trusted advisor. Can you tell us a little bit about how that intersection happened?
Yeah, well, the intersection was actually through Meredith. I think she must have known each of us independently and saw that Eric had some needs there from did some estate planning for him. Is, you know, for the estate planning aspects, when you bring a potentially international dimension to it, also has some things that have to be addressed. And I met with Eric and his lovely wife, and we helped him go through that.
Yeah, excellent. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we get further into the story.
Can I say something about that?
Because
what it was is like awakening up to find out that the way business is conducted here is totally different than where I was coming from.
Well, talk to us about that. I mean, because there's clearly big cultural differences. We already touched on just name of roles being such a huge difference. So what, from a tax perspective, as a citizen or a resident, actually you were a resident of Ecuador, you weren't a citizen, you were a citizen of Honduras. Talk to us about how tax issues were there, how you perceive them to be there versus here.
Well, the main thing any government wants is to take as much taxes as they can, obviously. I mean, but the way the rules are set up, And what leeway you can find through the advice of your of the people you have to consult are different. Like the concepts, it comes from the fact that us, the general manager of a company, you're legally responsible for what goes on the books. The tax return form, obviously, you have to sign it, and there are some very serious consequences. So the ability of, that you can find or capacity to reduce the impact of taxes is very important. I mean, it's not like here. Like you have definitely 35%, 25% taxes on utilities or profit. But you have to add to that that you have to distribute 15% of your profit to your workers.
To the employees.
Wow. To the employees, yeah. So now you're talking about a 40% tax rate, basically.
All right.
So the impositive structure in Ecuador is totally different from the U.S. You don't have much fiscal credit. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all set up wherein, you know, you have to pay. You have to pay taxes. And now they've gone even farther by requiring you to pay taxes in advance. Like twice a year, you have to figure out taxes on your assets, taxes on your income, taxes on your receivables and payables. And they have a little formula, and you pay in advance. And supposedly you're going to deduct that next year. But it never happens because you always come up and have to do the same thing next year. So, again, you're making an advance in your payments. And it's set up usually wherein the advancement is higher than any taxes that you're going to have to pay.
Hmm.
So, and getting it back is...
I'm still intrigued with this forced distribution among all the employees. That's where I'm kind of hung up. So that's addition to salary that you might pay laborers or something. You have to give... You're forced to give them a percentage of the profits.
Yes.
No matter what their performance was?
Yes. It's 15%, and it's set up where 10% goes to the employees distributed evenly. The other 5% is distributed among them and their dependents. So you have to have a list of how many kids they have. Now, dependents can be from within wedlock or out of wedlock. And that's another thing that's different in Ecuador. I mean, whether a child is... from wedlock or out of wedlock, he has the same rights. And that plays into succession very, very strongly, which is another thing. You know, one of the first things you have to do when you have a succession issues is you have to make a publication in the newspapers after a court order and call out and see if there's any quote-unquote child out there.
That's no different than here, right, Richard, with creditors potentially?
Creditors of whom?
You're speaking, are you, Eric, are you talking about upon death, there has to be something in the newspaper saying, hey, if there's any other dependents, make yourself known? Or are you talking about
yes.
when they drop, okay.
Yes. I see, yeah, in the U.S., there's a publication of notice to debtors and creditors. You know, it goes in the paper, say, hey, if the estate's owed money or if you owe the estate money, you know, let us know. And so, but no, we don't have a similar law for determine the dependencies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other part, that part where you have to publish it so your whoever you owe, your debtors or your lenders, owe you money to show up, you have to do that too. But other than that, you have to come out and say, okay, anybody out there feels that they're the kids, or they have a right to the heir.
Does Ecuador have a minimum wage for workers?
Yes, it's $220 a month.
Okay. Right. I was just curious. There were some, you know, because in the U.S. we don't have, you know, this distribution of profits concept, but we have a minimum wage, and I was wondering if that may balance out somehow.
Well, the other question I would have is, do they have like a pension or for what we have, a comparable 401k, or is that 15% meant to be distributed to them for their retirement?
No, they get that money
outright.
Outright. There is. We have to. Put some money into a the word is really...
Like a social security or...
Like a trust or a...
Yeah, universal trust fund, wherein all the workers have to be affiliated to the...
like a union, almost, it sounds like.
It's not a union. It's a government entity. It's the Institute of Social Security, wherein, besides the $220 turn up to be about $380, because I have to deposit 10%, 11.25% of his salary to the Social Security. They have to give 10%. I also have to give one month's equivalent to 1 month's salary every year deposited for that retirement fund. Mm. Okay, but that retirement fund is regulated by the Institute. And usually you don't get the money you're supposed to get back. Like people might have $80 a month. Mm. So that's another big issue.
So their government is overseeing that group, so there's not it's only as good as the government that backs that, I suppose.
Definitely, yes. Mm-hmm. That's why when you talk about universal health and universal this and universal that, people like myself who have been exposed to that type of things shiver a little bit, because who's in control of it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to operate a business down there in this country, I know I have to calculate my payroll, and I have to assume Social Security distribution and or contribution, and I have to assume that I'm probably going to, in order to attract my people, have some kind of a retirement fund or 401k matching. But on top of that, I'm going to have to add this 15% cost onto that. So every employee is going to cost me just a little bit more.
You never know how much the employee is going to cost you till you have to let him go or he decides to quit. Besides this 15%, and you also have this other extra salaries, the 13th salary, the 14th salary, and the 15th salary. And depending on the new government that comes in, they kind of try to change him.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, like the 13th salary, means that you give them like 2 weeks worth of payment in December. The 14th, you give them a set amount, one salary, minimum salary, $220 in this case, at the beginning of the school year to help them out with school. And then when you have to let somebody go, whether they resign or you decide that you don't want to use them anymore, you have to give them severance pay. And the severance pay will change depending on how long that person has been working for you.
Mm.
Like you have 25% of the monthly salary that you have to pay for every year of service. And then you start adding on and on. So we have one big limitation there, that any worker can come in and work for 89 days without becoming a permanent worker. After 90 days, he becomes a permanent worker, and that changes the whole aspect of what you have to pay them and what your liabilities are.
Hmm. These are government mandated. The company can't say, hey, well, our severance is only going to be this long. These are government mandates. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, those are constitutional mandates.
So the big picture issue is if some business here wants to do business in some other country, whether it's Ecuador or Canada or Germany, they've got to do a lot of figuring out to see what the operations are going to look like over there, so they can plan for that, so it's not just a big surprise and they end up cratering a big chunk of their business.
Richard, to that point, what are the kinds of things from a legal aspect that if I'm looking to say I can expand here, certainly the global arena has made it very attractive to companies. And you're right, it's very clear from this little exposure that it's entirely different. From a legal standpoint and setting up the entity and all of those ramifications, I guess I'd like to make this two-part. Mm-hmm. What are the issues and what are the consequences in general?
Well, the consequences is the easy one. That's you can create a big loss for your company instead of a big profit, because you haven't planned for things that people could advise you about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about doing that? You know, there's business aspects of that and there's legal aspects of that. The in addition to being a lawyer, I also did an MBA before, so I sort of bring this this business viewpoint to how you do things. And if I'm a business owner here, one of the things I'm going to first figure out, if I want to go outside the country and expand my business is how do I do that? Mm-hmm. Do I really want to do that with my entity, with my business, or do I do it in little baby steps? You know, do I get a relationship with someone in that other country and have them, you know, serve as a sales agent or
a general manager?
Maybe. Yeah. Depends on the country. Uh-huh. You probably don't want to give someone that power in Ecuador.
Right. Doesn't sound like it.
And that's sort of the first issue that the business owner would have to figure out. If they decide that, no, this is something I need to have my own presence there, then you have to think through, do you do that with your business, with your entity? Do you form a subsidiary? Do you have to maybe venture up with someone in that country, mm-hmm. do it like a co-owned subsidiary, mm-hmm. There, and that's going to depend a lot on what your business is like and what the atmosphere in that country is like. Mm-hmm. In fact, I suspect there's even some countries where some type of local ownership is a requirement. But
that's the case in Ecuador. You have to constitute the company within Ecuador, and the general manager or at least one proxy has to be Ecuadorian resident. Mm-hmm. You just can't handle it from the outside. So you're right. You have to analyze all the different aspects of setting business up and how it functions and what are the liabilities, responsibilities, the advantages, disadvantages of doing business this way, that way. So you definitely have to come in and research, get a lot of advice. And if you can, the first step should be associate yourself with somebody that you can really trust, you know well, and kind of have them guide you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to give an example of that. My father is involved in the balsa business in Ecuador. Ecuador is a wonderful place. It's one of the advantages is that balsa wood, the only country that produces balsa wood in the world is Ecuador. Hmm. It's amazing. Anyway, this company here, Danish company with a subsidiary in the U.S., decided to go into the balsa business in Ecuador. And they went to Quito. They contacted some lawyers. You know, after a while, after they had sent about $500,000 down there and they didn't see anything was coming up, they decided to go check in. Through another financial advisor we knew, it turns out his son-in-law was the president of this American subsidiary. He talked to my father and says, can you help us out? He says, sure, what do you want him to do? I want you to go up to Quito every time we have a board meeting and kind of represent us. Okay, no problem. So he goes out there in the first meeting, and then he comes back, well, you guys have a little bit of a problem. Well, you've sent in so much money, I asked them where the money was. So we lent it out to suppliers. And I said, well, what kind of security do you have on that? And they pull out this handwritten pieces of paper that are useless and says, we gave this guy $50,000 to buy a piece of land. We gave this guy $100,000 to do this. So by the time I realized that they had lost $500,000. So it is not only getting involved with somebody, it's knowing who you're getting involved with. So mm-hmm. network, it also has a lot mm-hmm. to do with it. You know, mm-hmm. finding out from somebody who's been there what you have to do and who should you associate yourself with.
How does financing differ? I mean, when you, and this is, let me first start before, Eric, you give us real life stories. Richard, I mean, do companies that are looking to expand internationally, do they need to be using U.S. banks to finance an expansion internationally, or would they have to use local banks to that area to finance those operations?
Well, for the most part, there's no requirement that they use a particular, located bank. From a practical standpoint, they're going to want a local bank relationship because they're going to be operating there, and they're going to need some banking relationship there. Where the financing comes from will largely depend on the business's operations and plans. They may be able to just self-fund the whole thing. They may, in venturing up with someone locally, in the foreign jurisdiction, there may be some both sides putting in some money. The funding of the startup is one aspect of it, and there's also the the funding of the operations, because in international concepts there are other mechanisms that can come into play, like letters of credit, in terms of how to finance the receivable that you're creating by sending product out. So it does complicate things.
You know, you mentioned partnering up with someone in another country. And I would imagine that gets pretty well overseen, because I would imagine that the country might be concerned that that's being used in some way to circumvent things, right? So now I'm over here, and I think that I'm going to test the waters and learn the culture by partnering up with somebody. But what are the ramifications? It sounds like a great solution. But I would assume that you have to tread pretty carefully.
Well, yeah, and I think that's true, you know, whether it's partner up with someone overseas or partner with someone within the United States. A lot of the similar issues are there, which are, how are you going to operate together? How are you going to make decisions together? How are you going to end the relationship? And how does that look if you come to that point? And so it's a lot of different issues that need to be thought through.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen situations where people partner together to do business, and without that agreement in place, 10 years later they come to what constitutes irreconcilable differences, because mm-hmm. it is like a lot like a marriage.
Absolutely.
And that either ends well or doesn't, and it usually doesn't. Get wrapped into litigation, and mm-hmm. you've now multiplied the cost of termination, mm-hmm. Tenfold.
Yeah, so a business prenup is essential, and I would have to say even more so when it's between entities in different countries.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So what is Eric? What was your experience? Or you had talked a little bit about that earlier with financing in another country. If you just wanted to get a loan, you had talked about there being a percentage or something before you even go down that road?
Yes. First of all, like Richard mentioned, you have to analyze which way you want to go. Getting funds from an international bank to operate in Ecuador is, if not impossible, extremely hard. So you have to go down to the local financial system. And very high rates, 18% to 24% interest rates, short terms, 5 years. Mm. They don't understand the 20-year or the 30-year.
Mm-hmm. And those are in Ecuador currency too, right?
The dollar. The official currency of Ecuador is the dollar.
The U.S. dollar?
The U.S. Okay. dollar, yes.
Well, they
adapted that
something.
In 1999 to try to prevent hyperinflation from taking off.
Stabilize their foreign currency.
I'd like to say for our listeners, I was actually in Ecuador in 1998 when the banks failed. And I was 20, or my early 20s. So to watch, as being recently graduated from undergrad, to watch bank failures in a country, that was a very educational thing for me.
And to be a student without an ATM machine.
Well, there were ATMs, but it was still crazy watching the run on the banks.
Yeah. It was a bank holiday.
Yeah.
That's what they call it. They shut down the banking system for a week, and they called it a holiday. And then the next Monday, you say, well, you know what? You don't have sucres, which is what the currency then. Now you have dollars, and the exchange rate is 1 to 25,000. So all the liquidity you had suddenly lost 50% of its value. And then you have serious cash flow issues. And going back to that, one of the first requirements when you get a loan is that you have to pay a 2% fee up front. 1.5% goes to the Ecuadorian Society for the Cancer Society, and the other 0.5% goes to the Junta de Beneficencia, which is kind of like a non-profit organization that supposedly gives assistance to the most needy. It's a big bureaucracy. And then you have the bank will charge you what they perceive as their utility, the profit on it, which you have to negotiate that. It goes from 3 to 5%.
On top of the interest?
Yeah. So you're losing 10% up front, regardless. You never get it. You only have 98% of your loan. And the bank goes, you know, it's a risk. The risk we're going to take is it costs 5% on top of the going rate, the established rate by the government, which is established by the government, by the way, the central bank. And then from then on, you go on and on and on, and you might end up having to pay 18% a year, plus the 2% you already lost. So the question is, what type of business can sustain that financial mm-hmm. cost? It's very limited.
Richard, what so we've got a family business here in the States. They expand internationally. What implications does that have in terms of income tax and estate planning issues? If you could really jump in into some of that.
Okay. Well, let's address income tax first. Then the U.S. is you know, they're relatively unique in this field of income tax, where the U.S. wants to tax its citizens on income wherever they earn it, anywhere in the whole entire world. Most countries only tax you on your income within their country. And if, you know, if someone in France comes over to the U.S. and or even just earns income from the U.S. without coming over here, France isn't going to give them tax on that. The reverse is not true. If you're a U.S. citizen and you expand your business over into France, and your French operations are going to incur a U.S. income tax. Now, a lot of countries with the U.S. will have treaties so that there's some offsets, so you don't end up with a double tax. But that's one aspect that people don't think about when they're looking to expand their business.
In fact, though, even with the offsets, if it's not a double tax, you know, how bad could it be?
Well, you know, the U.S. tax, call it 40%, because you have state and federal. You know, so the question really is does the other country have a bigger tax? Because there may be some differential there. You know, I'm not familiar with what the income tax rates are in different countries around the world, but mm-hmm. it can vary pretty widely.
Wow.
Then from a the other aspect of that, to be from income tax perspective to be aware of, is if you've got, let's say you're in the situation where you have, gone in with some foreign investors on that expansion, those foreign investors, to the extent that they're earning income through you because of stuff sourced from the U.S., the U.S. will go and tax them too, even though they never step foot in the United States. So the U.S. has very broad reach when they're looking for their income tax, and the same is true from an estate tax perspective also. If you pass away and you've got assets here and assets there, and meaning in the U.S. and outside the U.S., that's all included in what your estate is.
But how can let me ask you this, because I get this a lot from clients of mine. I have a number of clients who have property in Costa Rica and through Central America, so my question is, how would the U.S. know that you have holdings there necessarily upon death? What's to prevent that person from not disclosing that?
Well, they could fail to file an estate tax return that what you're supposed to file, that reports all your assets and you've listed them. So,
but what if you didn't list your out of country?
Then you've committed a fraud on the United States.
Got it. Okay. I'm just trying to clear it up.
Yep. And then you've got all the can of worms that gets opened up once you do that.
Mm.
So, to a point, obviously, there's a bit of an honor system concept there, but it's an honor system that's got a big stick behind it, too. So,
mm-hmm.
The estate tax, I meant to mention something else on the mm-hmm. on the income tax side. When you have that foreign person overseas, if money's going to them, you've also got a withholding obligation, because the IRS recognizes, hey, if I'm supposed to be taxing getting income tax from this foreign person, how am I going to get it? They're overseas. Although my tax arm reaches very far, my ability to force them to do something doesn't. And so the U.S. puts a burden on the U.S. person, the quote withholding agent, who has the obligation to withhold that from the amount you pay over to the foreign person. You got to keep 30% and pay that over to the United States. Kind of like a payroll withholdings that companies do for their employees.
Right.
Same concept, but it's on a international level.
Right. So if I dip my waters in expansion by just opening up a sales operation, and then I'm going to see how that goes in a foreign country and expand from there, those salespeople are going to, I'm going to have to be taxing them and withholding inconsistent with what you just said.
Yeah, to the extent that that's considered U.S. sourced income, and there's, you know, mm-hmm. a bunch of ramifications you got to roll through to figure out whether it is or isn't. You know, are you, is that person there just selling something that you then ship, you know, mm-hmm. or is it stuff that you're placing there, like mm-hmm. the inventory that then gets sold in the foreign country? So
I'm sure this is a big issue right now mm-hmm. with a lot of people operating in China, especially for manufacturing purposes and all around Asia.
Well, that's right. Yeah. It's, tax is always a big something that has to be considered in all of its dimensions, whether it's income tax, estate tax, gift tax, you know, transfer tax, generation skipping transfer tax. I mean, it goes on and on. So mm-hmm. it does need to be well thought through.
Eric, you know, we're talking a lot about the nitty gritties, the legal and knowing those ahead. And there's certainly some key points coming out here and the tax ramifications. But we have talked previously a little bit about some other things to be aware of before you're going into a foreign country to operate. And I think those things relate more about the way, the unspoken way people do business. You know, you talked a little bit about culture. How does that play into when you're looking to expand or when you're operating in a different culture, a different country?
It's a fundamental concern. You really have to know what the culture or the thought process of the people in the country you plan to invest in. And I say this as an American, having been exposed to American education for so long, you grasp the concept of honor, like Richard just mentioned. That word doesn't carry much weight outside the U.S. for some reason or another. We have this big saying, the workers have this big saying, you know, the white guys. I was one of the white guys, not for my skin color, because I'm the head man, the boss. And they're viewed as kind of someone that I will try to get advantage of. He's the enemy. He's using me. He's exploiting me. He's not paying me what I deserve. So that whole, the cultural part is fundamental. And it's all based on the fact that there's lack of education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The education system outside the U.S. is, in Europe, is very, very deficient, which is an advantage for politicians. You know, it's easy to fool them.
So it sounds, again, it goes back to that partnering. If I'm going to be walking into a foreign country, besides partnering with a good attorney here and there and partnering with a good tax expert here and there, how do I get the lay of the land, if you will? How do I get a good understanding of that culture so I don't trip?
I think that's one of the hardest things to do, because there's a lot of facades and people. You know, nowadays you can research a lot. You use Google. You Google everything. But a lot of people put out there a certain facade, and you can be misled by that. So you definitely have to prepare for tripping a little bit at the beginning. Research as much as possible about everything, not just the legal aspect, the labor, the tax laws, the social part, and get involved and try to get a sense of what people think, you know. Talk to the people, find out what they think, how they think, how they behave, and to give you a better idea of what you're getting involved with. It's totally different. When you're talking with somebody who's basic, most of them have just had not even elementary education, the whole psyche of handling these people is totally different. And their behavior is not going to conform to the behavior you're used to having from your workers. It's just a different world.
So do you typically then want to have supervisory folks that are very clearly, you know, aware of those differences? It sounds like local supervisors seems to be a...
Yes, but then you always go back to one big word. You have integrity there. That's why, as a general manager, you tend to try to cover every detail. For example, in the legal labor, it got to the point where I had to approve all the hirings and the firings. Why? Because I wanted to make sure who was being hired, what his background was. And when I fired him, I wanted to make sure why he was being fired and what my cost was going to be, because I'm legally accountable to him, not only with company assets, but my own personal assets.
How?
How?
How are your personal assets on the line with that?
It's the law.
Oh, okay. They could come after you from a legal standpoint if it was...
Any labor lawsuit in Ecuador would say, in my case, Mr. Eric Papp, for the rights he represents of such and such company and his own personal rights. So they go after your own personal assets.
Wow.
So it is not unusual, and it's happened, that you decide you're going to go on a vacation. Everything's set up. Ready to go. You get to the airport. And getting out of this country is not like here where you go up to the counter and say, here's my passport, just give me my boarding ticket. You have to go to customs. And they check and see if there's some restriction. And they get put travel restrictions on you. So you get to airports that you can't leave the country. Why? Well, you have a labor suit. And they require that you be prohibited from leaving the country. Freeze your assets. Freeze company assets. And so on and so forth. So the labor environment in third world countries is very, very complex, very risky. And again, you have to really consult with lawyers who are specialized in that because it's so complex.
Right. I mean, business owners here have certain expectations that they just think is true wherever they go. You know, and when they travel outside or do business outside, they find out that's not the case. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I mentioned how the U.S. has, you know, this broad reach with their income tax laws and estate tax laws. The reverse is true in with their trademark laws. You know, trademark, say your company here has a brand and a logo and trade dress and all these intellectual property rights. They go out, see, you know, I've got my registered trademark, and I can protect it against everything. Well, those rights don't extend beyond the United States, and so if you're going to be doing business in other jurisdictions, you got to find out what do I need to do here in order to protect it. There's a famous case, sort of a reverse situation where there was a foreign company who was coming to do an Indian restaurant, apparently fairly famous in India, and they had locations, a couple other locations across the globe, and they came into the U.S. and registered their trademark and operated the restaurant in Chicago and New York. Did that for a number of years and then closed them both down. Well, two or three or four, I don't remember how many now, was of the employees who worked in there said, we can do this. So they opened up an Indian restaurant in New York City. Same menu, same uniform, same name of the restaurant, same look and feel. And you can imagine that the foreign company was very upset about this and said, well, we're gonna press our, you know, we're gonna press charges against these people and bring them to task. And they lost their case, the foreign company. They said, no, you've abandoned your rights in the United States, and your rights that are outside the states don't exist inside here either. So they learned a hard lesson. And that could happen the reverse. You know, if you're in the United States and you go, say, do business in Canada or France or wherever and think that you've got rights in your intellectual assets, that's not necessarily true.
Well, I mean, there's so many ramifications. It just sounds like, you know, most people will look at a foreign expansion and think of it from a market perspective, there's opportunity there. Maybe from a supply chain point of view, it's smarter to be closer to that. But certainly what you're pointing out, I think what I keep hearing is the biggest danger is if you think that you're one of your biggest expenses, which is your employees, if that's going to be able to translate directly into that country, that's going to be the biggest surprise of all, I would think.
Yeah, and different countries have different laws, too, about working hour requirements. Some countries are, no, they can only work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and that's it. Other countries will say, if there's overtime, here's what,
You get your holiday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, holidays.
It's always holiday.
And
right?
Holidays are different in different countries, too. You know, some people, it's not just Christmas. There's Boxing Day mm-hmm. the next day after. And there are just a lot of personnel issues, more so than a lot of the other aspects that just need to be thought through.
I want a holiday.
Yeah, for sure.
Move to Ecuador. You have a lot more holidays.
Every day is a holiday, huh?
Yeah, and Eric's point of getting to know someone there who can teach you more about the culture and expectations is a good one, too, because, there are countries where there are unofficial holidays, sure, like, for instance, maybe you close down, for Christmas or maybe that week. There's some places that say, from a practical perspective, a lot of the businesses just won't. They'll close down December 20th, and they won't reopen until January 6th. Hmm. It's not a formal holiday on the books, but just from a practical perspective, they know we're not going to get much business done during this period. So
that's very common. Shutting down the last 2 weeks of the year is very common. People just close and take off. And talking about holidays, we're going to have about a month worth of holidays. Coming up June 1st when the World Cup comes up.
Right.
Every time there's a game, hey, that's it, man.
Mm. Absolutely.
We're not working today, sorry.
So the unofficial holiday.
So, yeah. So Richard, are clients that maybe are residents of the U.S. but not citizens that are, like Eric, from another country and are here now, what are some ideas? I mean, do they need to be talking to an attorney about estate planning? You mentioned things were different, but you didn't really delve into how they're different.
Well, one of the things that maybe some permanent residents, quote, green card holders, which aren't green anymore, don't think about or realize from an estate standpoint is that they are taxed from an estate tax standpoint, very similar to a U.S. person. So now, just because even though they're not a citizen, they are a U.S., quote, U.S. person, and they are going to be subject to worldwide estate tax also, and they need to factor that in. And, you also have to look at the spousal relationship, not that it exists, but whether are they both U.S. citizens or not. Since one's a permanent resident, the other one might not be a permanent resident. There are let's take my example, for instance. My wife is from Bermuda. She is not a U.S. citizen. And if I were to pass away, let's do the normal situation. Normally, a husband and wife will be able to, when one passes away, the spouse can take the entire estate of the deceased spouse without any type of estate tax. And I need to premise a little bit. 2010 is a weird year right now because there is no estate tax, and is it going to come back in 2010 or not? And how is it going to look when it's in 2011? Those are all open questions that no one really knows. But for purposes of this discussion, we'll just pretend like estate tax exists. And normally the spouse would be able to get the whole entire amount free of estate tax because the government knows that they want the spouse to be able to live the rest of his or her life with that money. And they'll tax it eventually because the surviving spouse will pass away someday. So they just wait till that time comes. Now, in my situation, if I were to pass away, my wife would not be able to get the entire estate free of estate tax because the government says, well, what's to keep her from getting that all estate tax free and then leaving and then having the bad graces of dying outside the United States where I can't reach the money, so the government doesn't let non-citizen spouses, even if they're permanent residents, get that estate tax write-off. So you have to use some special mechanisms. There's something called a qualified domestic trust, and QDOT for short. And in order for me to have my spouse get the equivalent of this unlimited marital deduction, what they call, that money has to go into this type of special trust, and the trustee of that trust has to be a U.S. or a U.S. person. So, if I didn't know that and I didn't structure my wills that way, you know, we'd be in for an unhappy surprise when, you know, should I have passed away first, mm-hmm. or, you know, whoever the U.S. citizen spouse is. Mm-hmm. So it adds complexity both from a business perspective and an estate and individual perspective, and that's just one example.
I think the most interesting thing, Eric, when you were talking back about secession early in the program, you know, you just wouldn't think of having to put a notice out, and almost anybody and everybody who can claim that they are a family member could actually show up and at least complicate and slow things down. I mean, if not stop things dead in their track.
Yes, and in some cases, Spain, for example, you have to, by law, include all your children and all your respect. You can't make any exemptions. Mm-hmm. Like, you can say, I won't leave anything to this kid, and I'm going to leave so much to this. You have to include them all forcibly. That's called forcible.
A forced share?
Yeah. Mm. So you can't, you can do a estate planning, but it's regulated
even if
by
it's
the
a,
government.
Even if it's a daughter? You can't write the daughter out?
No.
Okay.
Not in Spain.
Georgia actually has a somewhat related concept called a year support, where the surviving spouse and any minor children have an entitlement to a, quote, year's worth of support from the estate if whether or not they're named in the will as a beneficiary. But that's something they have to actively ask the court for. It just doesn't occur automatically.
Yeah, and plus, if in the U.S., I thought you can, as long as you specifically state in the will that you recognize this child, but you're choosing not to leave them any assets, you can do that.
You absolutely can do that. But if they're a minor child at the time of your death, then they can assert a year support right, and that year support can be anywhere from the entire estate, no matter how big it is. If no one objects to your assertion of that right, to a true actual calculation of what it takes for you to survive, you know, on support for a year, if someone does object.
Well, there's a constant theme, as often emerges from our programs, one that has been in all of our programs since we launched the show, which is, you know, if you're going to do anything that is outside your area of expertise, assembling trusted advisors is critical. Listening to you both today, it's very clear that if you for some reason believe that expanding internationally looks to be the right way to go for all the issues that we've said about supply chain, et cetera, in those instances, all the more critical to have a really expanded team of advisors, because you need the cultural expert, you need the legal expert, the tax expert on both sides of the border, wherever you're expanding to. It certainly seems that that's really critical. Richard, we like to have our show have tips at the end, and kind of along the lines of that summation, are there some real tips if somebody is sitting there thinking that the best choice for many reasons is to expand, but what should they be watching out for?
Well, you know, I think in the big picture, you know, the tips are, don't rush. You know, take your time and really understand what the differences are that you're going to be up against, because otherwise the potential downside is just too great. And two is get help. You know, yes, there's a lot of free help you can get out there to begin with. I think it's good to seek that, you know, through the Department of Commerce has a lot of good information. There's a CIA World Fact book that if you want to target some specific information of a country you're looking at, look at that. But then, you know, bring that team together, both locally and in that jurisdiction, because no domestic attorney is going to know really how to do things in some other country. And just expect there to be differences in everything you do. It just sort of, when you go international, it gives a new meaning to the phrase that we're not in Kansas anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's excellent. Eric, from a family business, a member of a family business, from a general manager in a family business, and from someone who has certainly seen the world, what tips would you have?
Well, I would reiterate what Richard just said. Research. Do as much research as you can. That can get as much advice as you can. But the research is fundamental, because that way you can digest the advice you're getting from people, because people have different perspectives. Network, be wary. Definitely be wary. You know that you're going to face a whole different set of rules, and know that you will be looked upon differently as a foreign entity, like it happens to every immigrant anywhere in the world. You're different. So rules will apply to you differently. Do everything by the book, and be patient.
Wonderful. Well, we really appreciate you gentlemen joining us today.
Well, thank you, Pat and Meredith, for having us here.
Yes, yes, thank you.
Great. It's always great info. And if you want more info, I always like to let our listeners know how they can reach you. Richard, if they wanted to talk with you a little bit about this topic or any of the topics that you shared that your firm specializes in, how would they reach you?
Well, they can call me on my direct phone number if they want, which is 404-364-6630. Or they can shoot me an email at rbennett, which is B-E-N-N-E-T-T, at kkgpc.com.
Excellent. And Eric, how can they reach you?
They can call me on my phone. It's 678-446-2055. Email at egpapps@gmail.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn, which is an easier way to find me.
Well, and another way you can find both of them and actually find this podcast, which will be up on early of next week, and all of the podcasts that are in our repertoire up on our site, would be to go to our site, which is www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. You'll also see Eric and Richard's contact information up there, as well as ours, and we encourage you to do that, and we really encourage you to download this podcast and keep it as reference. So thank you again, and we'll see you next week.